Welcome to EB5 Investment Voice, where attorney insights intersects with immigration investments. If you are a foreign investor, domestic fund manager, or enterprising entrepreneur and want to get the most out of the EB5 program, you have come to the right place. I'm Mark Deal, and I'll be your co-host on this journey. I'm joined by your host, Mona Shaw, and other attorneys at Mona Shaw & Associates, as well as immigration leaders from around the world. So let's get into EB5 Investment Voice.
Hey, Mona, how you doing?
I'm very well, Mark. How are you?
I am doing great. I know today we're going to be talking about the structure of EB5 projects, and I'm excited for today's guest. Today we have Patrick Hogan. He's the CEO and managing member of CMB Regional Centers. Mr. Hogan has considerable experience in the EB5 industry dating back to 1994. It's 23 years.
Yeah, wow, Mark. I would say that Pat is really one of the grandpas of the industry.
He may not like the term as grandpa, but it certainly establishes him as one of the most experienced practitioners of EB5. So, Pat, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. Glad to be here. Being referred to as grandpa is something I look forward to as my son just got married.
Hope for the future there.
Well, thank you again, Pat, for joining us. Many of our audience have heard of CMB. I think there really isn't anybody out there who haven't heard of CMB. But just in case there is that one or two little person maybe on a desert island somewhere, would you like to explain a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I got started in EB5, as you said, in 1994, before Regional Centers started. We won't even go through that 1994 through the years 2000 of all that fraud and abuse. But let's just say that I lived the wars of the very early years of EB5. I came back into it in 2007. It's been an interesting run, and really nothing changed. We still have the same structure, the same everything we did back in 1997 when we got our regional center certification. We're up to 10 regional centers, though, today, and over 5,000 investors and 60 projects. So it's become quite a giant.
That's one of the things I was going to ask you. Where are you based?
We're actually based in Quad Cities in a small town called Rock Island, Illinois, which is right on the Mississippi between Iowa, Illinois, and about 160 miles west of Chicago.
Okay. But your regional centers, they span most of the middle part of America?
Oh, they go from California all the way up into Maryland, Georgia, North Dakota, Illinois, Texas. And usually we go for full state designations and sometimes two states when we did Florida, Georgia, because we have projects literally all over the United States.
Right.
Yeah, I'm looking at the map now, and I can tell it's really covered with states that you have projects in.
Well, Mark, that brings me to a really sort of thorny question that I'm going to throw at Pat from the very outset. I usually sort of lead with people in a little easier, Pat, without giving you difficult questions, but I'm going to give this to you. We've had guests on the show who have their regional centers in places like, you know, New York City, and in this sort of other big cities in Texas and in DC, et cetera. That is often what investors hear all the time, that, of course, location is so important to a project, but the location needs to be a big city. Your projects are not in big cities. How are you successful?
Well, our mantra is take care of the client and we'll make money. So if you structure a project such that the likely return of their investment and the likely outcome of their immigration pursuit is assured, it doesn't matter about the location. So, you know, we had a biofuel plant in North Dakota. I felt just as good about that particular project as I did others. It's very, very important to look at a project. Simply a project located in a very highly desirable area doesn't mean the project will be successful. It's all about the structure of a project.
Well, I would argue, though, that, and I often advocate this, the location is really important. Even if you are in maybe a non-big city area, you still need to be, for example, on a busy street if you're a hotel, no?
Mona, I wouldn't say that. Because you're a hotel, yes, needs to be in a good location simply because of the type of business that it is. However, The structure of the business is more important to the client. The client needs to dig deeper and say, how am I assured that the job creation is going to occur and that what's the likelihood of me being repaid? So you could have a hotel just like they did in the Chicagoland Regional Center, and Chicago is a very large city, but it failed. And so the question really is, it's all about the structure. And every one of the investors, you know, they're supposed to have an active role in the investment. At least they should have an active role in doing their due diligence to find out themselves. Many times they ask the wrong questions. They start out by saying, how much money am I going to get? And if I was an investor seeking an EB-5 visa, I would ask, how do you prove the jobs? Because without the jobs, you have nothing. You are not going to be successful. So that would be my first question on any regional center. And so proving the job creation will assure them, A, of their visa, and then they can start asking questions, let's say, about the monetary side of the investment.
Yeah, the very good point. But there's another thing. I'm very passionate also about non-real estate projects coming into EB-5 because I feel like, yes, real estate projects are good, but the program's been hijacked by certain types of big, glamorous real estate and hotels. And often investors come to us and they think that's all that you can have. And I have to explain. I said, no, there are other types of projects. Look at those types of projects too. And don't just write them off because they're not big real estate projects.
Sure. I started out working with the former military bases. And, you know, individuals were selling ski resorts and showing pictures of people happy going down a mountain. And I was actually investing in a sewer. So I didn't think I could take pictures of sewer and that, and that would entice people. But actually, infrastructure creates a tremendous amount of jobs. So that I knew, and when I was able to talk to the people and convince them, hey, look, you know, this project is going to create the jobs. And by the way, it's with a governmental entity in that those are the ones who are responsible to pay you back. It gave that safety, you know, thought process. So it really wouldn't matter where it's at. It's how safe is the project? How is it constructed? And, you know, what's the likelihood of me achieving the two results that really most every investor is looking for is, A, first, they want the green card, and second, they would like a return of the capital investment.
Okay, let's talk about the return of the capital investment for a moment. Then if it's all about structure, where would you expect, if we have a lot of attorneys, for example, who are listening and they advise their clients, how would you advise them to look at a project? Bear in mind that I know a lot of EB-5 is business and corporate law, and unfortunately it comes to immigration attorneys who are not proficient in these areas to this extent that you would really require it. And therefore, often it has to be simplified. But if you just took out a couple of bullet points, what would you tell them to look at?
First, I would tell them to find an attorney that does understand the business questions that are actually immigration questions. For instance, the requirement of 10 jobs is not a business requirement. That's an immigration requirement. Where you locate the investment is an immigration requirement, not a business requirement. The likelihood that the investment is going to be successful is really an immigration requirement, because without the successful business, you don't have the jobs and you don't have the return of capital. So I have been preaching, and sometimes to much of the chagrin of the lawyers, is that they, in a sense, they need to actually address those issues, and many of them don't. And I think that an investor who does have an attorney, they need to answer those questions. They need to take a look at the regional center the individual has chosen and make sure those due diligence questions are answered together, you know, as their advocate. And if they do that, I think they will be in a much better position.
So in looking at a due diligence question, for example, the capital stack, which now people are trained to look at, is that something that you would suggest people look at straight away? What is the capital stack? What is the debt actually in the project?
Well, yes, you have to start with that anyway to look at your job creation. Yeah. And in the capital stack, there can be things such as, let's say, purchase of land. That doesn't create a single job.
Right.
And so therefore, you have to tear apart that capital stack and say, wait a minute, is EB-5 money going and where is it going? And then once it's done, is the capital stack such that the project will be completed? And also remember that there are things that you can put in the projects that can assure, let's say, at least the visa availability will be taken care of. For instance, you can have a completion bond. You can have a, if you're doing a construction project, you can have what's called subguard insurance, which is insurance on some of the various subcontractors. So the more protection that you build into that capital stack and to ensure that that project will be built, the more likely that the jobs will be created because of, you know, the building or construction project will occur. And remember, you know, they said that why is it in one of the hearings that EB-5, you know, has used construction much more than the average, you know, throughout the United States, being only 6% of our economy. The answer simply is you can prove jobs so easy in a construction project, and that it's empirical evidence that really cannot be denied by the USCIS.
That's true, but I would argue also that there are many other types of projects where you can count the jobs. We've touched on infrastructure, for example. I'm very into transportation as well. And we've also, I mean, in our office, we've had projects in sort of places like forestry and manufacturing. Unfortunately, they don't really attract investors in the same way, but they do have the job creation.
Well, let's take manufacturing as an example. You could have invested in Solrenda, which was a manufacturer of, you know, the PV panels, and, you know, you would have failed because they went under. So in those particular situations, you cannot protect yourself against failure. You have to have a high degree of confidence in a manufacturing plant or something along that line that the business will actually, A, create the jobs they say they're going to create, and B, that they will be there in the 5 years or whatever it's going to take for you to reach your 829.
Right. But I think for me, when I talk to investors, their feeling is, well, with the manufacturing processes and whatever, okay, yes, their jobs can be created, but I don't see the certainty of my money back because the assets aren't there. And they see projects where there are real estate, like a hotel, as being an asset and somehow being a quote unquote a guarantee that their money is safe.
Well, as we know, that's not necessarily true. You do have to look at you because, for instance, if there is no equity in the project, and many projects are built with almost the principal who is doing this, almost putting no money in it himself. You know, we're doing a Great Wolf Lodge project in Georgia, and that project itself has got so much of the individual's equity that I know that if, in fact, that hotel complex was to fail, there is enough equity in there to take care of the investors in that respect. So that's the structure that we're talking about. You want somebody to have skin in the game, and then they're going to do a much better job. And so as you look at the capital stack, you don't want to be in a position where you have no, you know, recourse or collateral or anything along that line. So even if the project fails, let's say, now we're all fighting over the assets, and it's really incumbent upon the regional center to put the investors in a position that they have some recourse if, in fact, the project does fail.
Pat, how do you feel about regional centers where the regional center themselves have been set up for their own project rather than like the way CMB is, which is a third-party regional center, whereas you're doing projects for other people, correct?
Yes. We call them vertically integrated projects. In other words, where the individual actually owns the property, he's going to maybe construct something on it, then manage it and own it. To me, without an outside audit on something like that, that is a very dangerous project to get into. And, you know, one of the things that, and I'm not touting and told not to do that, but one of the things that we should do is assure our investors as regional centers that we are treating, you know, their monies in a proper way. So an example, and a good example that I felt that we set was we had BKD audit every single one of our 60 partnerships all the way back to the inception. And then each year now we do a third-party audit of each one of them. And I think, you know, that's a best practice that you could look for in a regional center to say, hey, you know, every one of this guy's projects are being audited every single year, and that's available to every one of the investors. So there are ways you can make an investor through structure feel much safer. And therefore, I don't think it depends on whether I'm in New York or whether I'm in North Dakota or in Georgia or, Tennessee.
I totally agree with you, Pat. Where do your investors tend to come from? I know you're all over the place. I see your boys at seminars from Dubai to to Kazakhstan, but where do you get your investors from?
Well, when I started, I didn't go to China. You know, back in the 90s, Taiwan was the hot market.
Yeah.
You know, but because of the massive failures in the 90s, the Taiwanese market is a very hard market to crack because of the licensing requirements that caused them that. But, you know, I got most of my investors from Korea and from other parts of the world before I went to China. So we're not as dependent upon China as others. We have 83 different countries that we have investors from, which really creates an interesting challenge to us on the languages. But we do have, I believe we cover 17 different languages. We have individuals on the ground in China. We have individuals on the ground in Vietnam, in Africa, and also in Turkey, which can then cover Dubai and Turkey and that. It's so, you know, we have them on the ground working with the various agencies and or finders. They're not allowed to really sign an investor, but they're just there to support and to help the individual finder group that's out there answer questions on CMB.
Right. We had a guest on the show just last week who commented about how they do not like to go to agents in China because of the amount of money agents are asking, and basically how projects who just rely on agents may not be reliable because so much money is going out in commissions.
Yeah, that's a very tough subject now. And of course, the pressure is on. If you're working with agencies now, the price of investor, you know, could go all the way up to $200,000. And they do that basically through syndication fees and paying points on the backside. The problem there is it now has taken the focus off of the quality of the investment, okay, and how much money the middleman is getting paid. And that is a real issue. And so, you know, I think that in the end, the agencies are actually cutting their own throats, because sooner or later, the public is going to get wise to the idea that the agency is only putting them in this particular project or that particular project by how much money they're getting paid, not necessarily on the qualities of the actual project.
You know, I totally agree with you. When we first started in this industry, and I didn't start as early as you, but back in 2006, 2005, even up to, I would say, 2010, 11, really social media wasn't there. So it was really dependent on the agents. Now that social media is there, and because there's so much more access, even from China, we get a lot of direct inquiries. And exactly for what you're saying, people just have stopped trusting some of the big agents.
Well, I think eventually when the word gets out how much of these money these big agents are requiring, and remember something, the more money that the agencies require when they're getting these interest points each and every year, that puts more pressure on the project.
Yeah.
And therein lies the problem, is the project now has another burden every single year to generate more income to pay the agent, which makes no sense.
Yeah, absolutely. I've heard this across the board. In a project saying, look, we can't afford that. And who would suffer but the investor?
Exactly. And so I think, you know, through WeChat and some of the social medias that you talked about, especially the China market needs an education on these agencies that, frankly, are really abusing the EB-5 investor. In a sense, there's really nothing that the U.S. government, SEC, or anybody else can really do, except maybe if we can make them report how much they're paying. But
I think that's mandatory. I think that if they did that, I think that would start to curb at least some of the abuses.
But then again, my advice to the individual investor, they must do their due diligence and ask the question, how much are you getting paid? We say, don't believe anything a regional center is saying to you, including us. Make us prove it. And I came across a problem. Somebody said, well, how do I know that you have 5,000 investors? And so what we've done is BKD also not only audits our finances, they also audit our EB-5 statistics. So we know that we can say, hey, we have an outside auditor that looked at these statistics, and then, in fact, they are true. So we're constantly trying to move the bar forward on these integrity measures so that the investor feels safe.
Pat, when I'm talking to investors and we're talking about due diligence, we often talk about why that particular project is using EB-5. Most of the time, when we're talking about like large real estate, they're using EB-5 because it's cheaper. You know, mezz loan coming in at 11 to 13%, obviously EB-5 is cheaper. But there are projects where they are simply not able to get conventional financing. And I would you go to some of the areas like maybe even in transportation. Right now, it's extremely difficult to get conventional financing. Wouldn't you suggest that projects where they've used EB-5, where they can't get conventional financing, is a good reason?
Well, I think it's an excellent reason. And matter of fact, I think that's what the program was really about when they first started, was the idea that EB-5 could be used to give communities a leg up, you know, in getting and attracting investment capital. So when you look at infrastructure projects, sometimes the need is there, but the money is not. So timing is so important on infrastructure projects in the United States. However, infrastructure is the gift that keeps on giving. Once you build the basic infrastructure, sometimes it could begin with demolition, and then it starts with horizontal construction, and then vertical construction, and then on that vertical construction, you also have job creation there. So, and then you have revenues from the eventual company that locates there. But I'd like to go back a little bit to the various structures that we talk about. There's either loan or there's equity. And one of the things that's historically amazing to me is that, to my knowledge, there has not been an equity. But I'm going to say very, very few equity models in the history of EB-5 have ever paid anyone back. On the converse, you have both Can-Am and I who have returned hundreds of millions of dollars to individuals when they've completed the EB-5 pursuit under the loan model. And I really think the loan model is superior and it provides a defined exit strategy. If you enter into an equity model, you have no idea. They have to sell something. They have to perform. They have to, there's so many variables associated with an equity model that in many cases, the investor is really taking a chance. You know, there's an upside potential possibly if you could find the right equity model, but there's got to be something to the fact that historically in EB-5, we haven't seen many equity models, if any, pay back in entirety.
I can see that, Pat, because what you're saying is, you know, with the equity, even if it is a successful project, it does well, the valuation of that project goes up, so the investors' equity, their portion is worth more. Even with defined exit strategies, it's not quite as liquid because they would have to find somebody to take over that equity to essentially cash out. So do you think that's why you don't see, although there may be some equity, a few equity-based EB-5 deals, you personally, with 23 years of experience, you haven't seen personally an investor cash out of an equity EB-5 deal?
Yeah, I can say that. I guess maybe if I look really hard, I could probably find one. But I'm going to tell you right now, the major players, the big players that we know of, and I'm not going to mention names, they have never paid out on a complete project. And it comes to the point that either maybe it's more profitable and the investor wants to stay in, but more likely is that they can't find a buyer. And remember, they're a minority.
Right.
Well, they're a minority owner. They might be 1/80th of a 50% of a project. So it's, you know, they become such a small part of a project, they have no power to force the liquidation. And if they do, they usually have to take a tremendous beating on their original capital investment.
Pat, but there is another point. As we're moving to different parts of the world for EB-5, other cultures do kick in. And there are some cultures in the Middle East, for example, where they only believe in equity. They don't really believe in the loan model. So we have seen a number of smaller projects, sometimes direct pooled and sometimes regional center, where they just focus on equity because perhaps most of their clients are coming from Iran or some other Middle Eastern country. Do you have any comments?
I don't. It's just my opinion and my structure that, I'm not going to try to fix something that's not broke. I know that if in fact somebody wanted an equity position, then why don't they use the actual direct method of EB-5 and put their money into a company that they can control? That would be my advice to anyone that is willing to do that, because then they have somewhat of control. But in a regional center concept, they're only a very small portion of what the equity is, because they're going to be one of so many investors that put their money in. So my advice to them would be to look at a direct model as opposed to a regional center model for equity.
Well, let's get back to loan structures then. What recommendations would you have for loan structures of EB-5 projects?
Well, when you're in a loan structure, you've got to be careful that, A, you've got to, you know, conform to the 40s Act. And so you've got to make sure that you can drill down to the land to get the exemption or get a membership pledge. And when you do that, that's, you know, very good collateral for the individual investor. The idea of having an exit strategy, it's, you know, our loans have always been 6 years because we started out with infrastructure and they needed that time for the tax increment financing to grow to be able to pay off the loan, which has been a very successful model. So what I would suggest to you is that you don't want to be behind a mezz lender who's loaning at 15 to 18%, taking 15% of the project, and you are the last man on the capital stack, and the likelihood of you not getting anything, if in fact there was a failure, is high.
Increased.
Yeah, so that's why you want to look at equity. Remember that equity is the last to get paid. So if an individual has put a tremendous amount of equity in a project like the Great Wolf Lodge project we're in, it was a no-brainer for us to do that project because we know that the main lender is going to get paid. We know based on our calculations that the hotel will be worth X amount of dollars. Okay, so therefore, even if it went into default, that we believe that we would have a very large portion of the equity would come to us, and the, you know, the actual person who put the equity in would be the final loser.
Right. And that particular project, it looks like it's $200 million for the complete build out, but only 36% of that is from that you're seeking is from EB-5. And that's probably to pay for all the construction and all the physical job activities that that are required.
Of course they are. You again, going back to the requirements of the EB-5 program, you want every dollar that you put into an EB-5 program to be job creating. So you want to make sure that your money is spent where they are creating jobs.
Yeah. So, Pat, this is great advice, especially for so many investors who are now trying to find out on their own because they don't trust agents or they don't trust middle people. So they are trying to come out and decide themselves whether a project is good or is not so good. So it's good to learn a little bit about structures from someone like yourself. But at the same time, what about the projects where you are really trying to help maybe a rural community or a community where they don't have that same kind of access to equity, but you do see a very strong, viable payback?
Exactly. That's where I saw in the North Dakota biofuel plant that you can look at a similar project and say, and that happened to be Blue Flint, was very profitable. And so what we were doing was really duplicating what we saw was a profitable structure that had previously been done. And so what we did was, you know, you go into these projects and the whole idea simply is, number one, you want to set it up so that the visa is assured, that in fact that you can know that the job creation will be there.
Right.
Second is, if the project were to fail, remember, you know, I don't look at something and say, how much money can I make? It's, you know, what can I afford to lose? And in this situation, I go into these and I say, wait a minute, what is the downside here? How bad is the downside if this thing doesn't perform or it doesn't do what it says? And, you know, you set a threshold level that you're willing to accept. And sometimes in these rural communities, you just can't do the project. And, you know, you would be doing the client a disservice. And that was the Des Moines Hotel project. I would have loved to have done it, but we just couldn't see a way that and it was a viable, wonderful project, but we just could not see a way that we could protect our investors enough. And God knows I wanted to do that project because it was a rural project in the home state where I run the regional center, but I just couldn't bring myself to do that project simply because I did not see enough protection on the financial side for the individual investor.
But that brings my that big question back, that wasn't this program meant for these type of areas? And if an investor cannot get their money back, then they are not going to invest in these type of areas. And then hence, they'll end up being in places like New York City or some other big city.
Well, I would, again, disagree with that. There are many rural projects that are very strong. And I pointed to a few that we've done. So, you know, in New York City, you could say that the luxury high-rise market is overheated. And I think that that's what they're saying now. So if you invested into a market that's majorly overheated, as opposed to in a rural market where you know you have a very good base collateral, you know the jobs are going to be created, I'll take that rural project any day over a New York project that talks about luxury condos.
That's true. But it's all down to marketing here, because the luxury condos have the marketing edge. You know, they make it more glamorous.
Well, sure they do. But the question isn't glamorous. The question is jobs. And the question is, how do I get my money back? Those are the two questions that the investors should really, you know, center themselves on. And location, in my mind, doesn't matter. If the two of those particular parameters are met, isn't that the goal of an individual investor, is to achieve their visa and to end up having the capital returned? If that's occurring in rural America, and, you know, and it happens on a regular basis, then why wouldn't you invest there? The point is I know that, you know, when we're talking about China, they have no idea where Colorado is almost. and I actually said that to Congressman Polis. I said, do you really think that people know where Colorado is over there? You know, so, you know, you're advocating for a position sometimes in what we're doing in this political battle for what EB-5 will be in the future. And yet they're not going to know where these rural areas are, but it's not about where the location of the project is. It's the quality of the project. That's where the investors are getting totally sidetracked. It's this glamorous thing that gets thrown at them and, you know, and gets sold to them. How many of these projects have been sold to them that are not what they are? And I don't want to pick on individual, you know, projects that said, we're doing this and it's in a wonderful city. When it turns out, when you get into the due diligence, no, they're not. You know, they're building a transportation hub. They're not building the stadium. And so, the investor has got to do the due diligence and then look at the two things. What's the likelihood of my visa, and what's the likelihood of the return of capital? And beyond that, it doesn't matter where the project is.
Well, I can certainly see the appeal of glamour marketing. Well, hopefully this podcast will add some glamour to these rural area projects. You know, you've mentioned the Great Wolf Lodge project in Georgia, which is in a rural area south of Atlanta. I'm looking forward to that project, because right now I take my daughter up to North Carolina every year for her birthday, Great Wolf Lodge, and I would very much like one closer to the city of Atlanta. I mean, I live in a metropolitan area. We're surrounded by rural areas. So that's one example of a rural area project that I would think would have great, tremendous appeal. Patrick Hogan, thank you so much for coming on EB-5 Investment Voice and really exploring the structure of EB-5 projects with us.
Thank you, Pat. You really brought a different perspective as well to the program.
Well, I appreciate being asked on the program, and I'm very humbled by the ability to be able to communicate with so many people. So thank you both.
Thank you for being with us today on EB-5 Investment Voice. The topics presented in this podcast is informational in nature and is not to be taken as specific legal advice. If you have questions on the topics presented in this episode or other investment immigration needs, please contact Mona Shaw & Associates. Mona and her attorney staff can be reached at mshawlaw.com. That's mshahlaw.com. Make sure you don't miss our next episode focusing on a different aspect of the EB-5 program by subscribing to the podcast. While you're at it, leave us a rating on iTunes. If you really found this episode valuable, share it with someone else that could benefit from this information. Until then, I'll see you on the next episode of EB-5 Investment Voice.